From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast.
With the weird...
No, let it go. On the Weekend Podcast, Evan engineers. It's always
and we lose all of our quality sound.
That's pretty true, actually. Yeah, please tell your friends who like Connections that we actually do a Weekend Connections podcast, which is a review of the week. And, you know, frankly, it's a review of the moments that stand out to us, the most poignant, the most touching, the most explanatory. And we're going to start at a place that it was a hard, very hard conversation. We're going to begin our week in review with reflections on two survivors of the Holocaust.
Next Thursday marks 80 years since Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. We talked to two Holocaust survivors who have vivid memories of that night and the horrors they witnessed in Nazi Germany.
And their names are Werner Schenk and Warren Heilbrunner. They said the fears they had as children came back last weekend after the mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh. You will hear from both of them in this clip. First, we start with Werner Schenk describing how he felt as soon as he heard the news out of Pittsburgh.
I expected a knock on the door and the Gestapo coming for me. I had shivers up and down my spine. I couldn't believe that this was happening. And it continued. You know, I'm a graduate and also worked at the University of Rochester. And a swastika was smeared on the elevator at the Eastman School of Music. Same day or the next day. So it's the same reaction I had when Kristallnacht happened. I kept asking my parents, why is this happening? And that's my question now. Why is this still going on? I don't have an answer. I don't think I ever will.
Warren?
Well, for me, it was sort of a benchmark because, as was reported, this was the largest killing of Jews in the United States, and it just harkens back to the killings that were going on in Germany. And the saddest part is that although there was a hue and cry outside in the press everywhere about the event, the sad part is that for many, many people, it probably said, oh, another shooting in this country. When will it end? That's the real question. When will this hatred that's going on, even with politicians, when is it going to end? And you just wonder, when's the next shoe going to drop and where?
It is correct to point out that according to the Anti-Defamation League, this is the most deadly attack on the Jewish community in this country, in our history. Warren and Werner, do you feel generally unsafe at all? And I don't mean to sort of ask an obvious or flip question, but I do think it bears asking if you have felt less safe in recent years, today than perhaps 5, 10, even 25 years ago, or if you view what happened in Pittsburgh as certainly a remnant of hatred, but not necessarily a mainstream trend.
Well, personally, I don't feel, you know, threatened. You know, I live in a community in Brighton, which, like the Pittsburgh community, you know, is many of the, most of the Jews in Rochester live in that area. I don't feel threatened for myself, but I feel threatened for my race. I really feel threatened for the Jewish community of the United States, because there are so many places in this country where Jews are not welcome. Not legally, because that's against the law, but practically, socially. And when you see a politician in Missouri whose campaign is, we want to get all the Jews out of the United States, it's reminiscent of Hitler's to make Germany Judenrein. What I feel probably worse about is what that effect is going to have on my children and my grandchildren. What is this country going to be like when they grow up?
Werner?
I'm not worried about personal safety where I live, but I worry more about places I go to. I've been invited to speak at a very large synagogue in New Jersey, where one of my cousins is going to organize a Kristallnacht, a remembrance ceremony in a very large synagogue. He told me there will be 500 people there. And the first question I asked him, what about security? Now, this would have never occurred to me even a year ago. But after the Pittsburgh thing, that was one of the first thought. I'm going someplace where I'm not familiar with anything. And what about security?
Next, the Trump administration wants to change how gender is defined. President Trump is considering redefining gender as unchangeable and determined only by a person's biology. That led to pushback in the transgender community and beyond, with trans people speaking out about the challenges they face and the misconceptions they say that a lot of people still have about them.
During the show, we heard from a listener named Kevin, who shared his views about the trans community. It's a tough call. You'll hear his reflections, and then you'll hear reaction from Amy Stevens and Penny Sterling, two local trans women. Here's Kevin.
I'm a contractor for years. I'm a middle-aged guy living with my middle-aged wife. Okay. And as far as running contracts, some of my best clients have been gay couples, alternative lifestyles, transgenders. I have no issue with them. I don't care. It's great to me. It's just my feeling, in all due respect, that they have a bigger issue dealing with themselves than my straight self has dealing with them. I just wish there could be a point where you don't have to be in my face about what you are or who you want to be. I don't care. I just think you could deal better with yourselves without accusing me of being an Archie Bunker, a meathead. And as far as raising young boys and how to control their testosterone, boys are going to be boys, and this world still needs men. I'm sorry. But I got bigger issues raising sons and grandsons than to how they're going to emotionally handle you. I'm not going to have them pick on you or make fun or belittle you. But once again, that's your issue to deal with, okay, to get over, to deal with yourself. That's all.
So, Kevin,
God bless you all.
Okay. And let me just ask you a quick question, if I could, before you go here. When you say that you think they have more of an issue, you know, with themselves than maybe...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you do have a presidential administration that may want to define them in terms of legal terms as essentially not really being real or existing. Do you think that's a concern?
Look, at the end of the day, Evan, when you come out the womb, if you have a penis, you're a boy. End of story.
Okay.
Done. Now then, that is their issue. I don't care what they think or want to do or want to be. I don't care. It's fine with me. At the end of the day, when you come out the womb, you got a penis, boy.
All right, Kevin, I got to jump in here. I mean, I take the point. I think we've heard that before. So apart from the last part, let me turn to Amy, because Amy was signaling during some of Kevin's comments there. When Kevin is saying, the trans community has more of an issue with itself than the rest of the world does with the trans community, unfortunately, Kevin's last comment sort of betrays that. But setting all that aside, let me ask you about your experience, because Amy, life has changed for you.
It's changing drastically, and it will continue to. And as a trans person out in the public space, I see the sideway looks. I see the sneers.
You do.
I see the cross-eyed glances. Most of the people, and I can deal with that. I can put up with that. And I've been confronted by people in public.
You have already. What did they say?
And it's just making fun of you, giving you a hard, hey, sir. And it's embarrassing. It's done to intimidate you, and it's done to make you second guess yourself.
Do they do it in a way that is laughing at you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was done mocking. And you know what? And I appreciate Kevin. At least he's honest and saying where he is and where he's at. And he's, fine. Kevin's, I appreciate that. You're going to let me live my life. I want that same respect back from society. And that's all that I'm really asking for you. If you're religious, conservative, great, you live your life, but let me do the same thing. But I see in a lot of society, the scariest thing to very religious conservatives is a happy, well-adjusted LGBTQ community. Because we upset their whole definitions of what gender and family are. And that's where the animosity comes in, because when we're well adjusted and operating within society, we're not the boogie person anymore.
Penny, I'll echo what Amy had to say. Kevin, I'm glad you called. It's important that we air out all kinds of perspectives, and they are all welcome here as we continue to try to understand one another. Go ahead, Penny.
Earlier in this week, I was actually on a podcast with the Rochester Business Journal talking about this issue. And one of the questions that was asked at me to me at the end was, what can businesses do to help the transgender community? And my immediate response was, believe us. And that's really all it comes down to, is believe us when we say we are who we are. And if we get past that, if we get that, that legislation is important and needs to be done because not enough people believe us. And so that's, but the bottom line is that, do you want to help us? Just believe us when we say this is who we are, this is what we want, and this is, and also this is not who we are.
We'll end the week with a look at the Republican Party and how some political commentators say it has evolved over the last decade or so. Norm Ornstein is a political commentator and author whose book, One Nation After Trump, explores this issue. He was in Rochester for the Jewish Book Festival.
And we want to be clear, on future programs, yes, you will hear conservative voices, Republican voices, also reflecting on the same themes, but Ornstein has earned a reputation as an analyst who has a lot of friends across the aisle. And in this clip, he discusses why he thinks President Trump is a manifestation of intentional decisions made by the Republican Party over time. Let's listen.
Trump didn't just emerge from nowhere. He was the product of a lot of these things that have been going on. And if you look at the election in Brazil, which now has a Duterte-like, they call him a populist, but he's really an autocrat. We see seeds of this all around the world. And some of it is the kind of populist instinct that's deep in America's DNA that emerges whenever there are economic difficulties and can last a lot longer. But what I've seen with the Republican Party, and it goes back even more than a decade, it started with Newt Gingrich deliberately tribalizing our politics, moving from partisanship and even ideological polarization to tribalism, which is very different. It's not you're our distinguished opponents who believe different things, but we can work together. You're the enemy trying to destroy our way of life. And frankly, what it amounts to is a party that saw that demographically it was starting to become a minority party. And you have two choices. You have a crossroads. You can either begin to alter not just your rhetoric, but your policies to try and broaden your appeal so that you can actually appeal to a broader electorate, or you can double down on a base and use things like voter suppression and words of division to get your base activated and angry and turning out in larger numbers and then suppress the other sides. Reince Priebus, after the Republicans lost the presidency in 2012, remember the chairman of the Republican National Committee, did this autopsy that basically said we've got to try and reach out to some minority groups. And then by 2016, when he became the chief of staff to Trump, completely abandoned that and they decided to go even further on the politics of division and fear. And this has been building for a long time. It came before Trump. It has been reinforced by Trump. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, John Cornyn, all of the leaders of the party, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who jammed through not just the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, but also now has been holding hearings against all norms and convention during a recess to try and jam through more judges. All of them are complicit in this. No party is angelic. Democrats, you know, politics is hardball, but we have a very distinct difference, and the polarization and the approach is asymmetric. And that's just a reality that I can't avoid.
One more quick point on that before we get to the phones. I think it puts the media in a hard position. If, to the extent that a journalist might agree with your assessment, the journalist still fears the public saying, well, if you point that out, you are biased and you are engaging in team sports. And that's tough for media that wants to remain nonpartisan. I mean, people have biases. I always say there's no unbiased, objective media. We all are human beings with biases. The question is, are you self-aware of your biases, and can you do it in a way that is not necessarily beholden to a team sport or a partisanship? But it gets awfully hard these days when the media is tired of being accused of partisanship.
And understood. And, you know, for decades, as I've been immersed in politics in Washington, I work closely with people from both parties. One of my dear friends, and I dedicated a book to him, was Barbara Conable, who represented the Rochester area for a long time, one of the greatest public servants I've ever encountered. But in 2012, when Tom Mann and I did our book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and an excerpt from it, the day it was before it was published, was in the Washington Post Outlook section, and our editor, Carlos Lozada, helpfully titled it, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans Are the Problem. We had reached a conclusion that it seemed to me was an undeniable one. I mention all that because the pushback we got from many in the media was, hey, we report both sides. And my reaction to that was that a balanced treatment of an unbalanced reality is simply wrong. And what we've seen is journalists are inculcated with the idea that you report both sides. But not for decades, as I've been immersed in politics in Washington. I work closely with people from both parties. One of my dear friends, and I dedicated a book to him, was Barbara Conable, who represented the Rochester area for a long time, one of the greatest public servants I've ever encountered. But in 2012, when Tom Mann and I did our book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and an excerpt from it, the day it was before it was published, was in the Washington Post Outlook section, and our editor, Carlos Lozada, helpfully titled it, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans Are the Problem. We had reached a conclusion that it seemed to me was an undeniable one. I mention all that because the pushback we got from many in the media was, hey, we report both sides. And my reaction to that was a balanced treatment of an unbalanced reality is simply wrong. And what we've seen is journalists are inculcated with the idea that you report both sides. But not every issue has both sides. Sometimes you have many sides. Sometimes there's really one side. Saying that somebody's lied is just not in the DNA of journalists very easily. But it's been a part of the problem that we have. And we're starting to see some inching away from it because now you got people being hit in between the eyes with a 2x4 over and over again with a reality, including the reality of what Trump says and tweets every day. But it's still there in a very deep-seated way. And it's hard to get away from it. I'm hopeful that we will. It's not a matter of moving over to just pounding Republicans. It's a matter of looking at a reality and reporting the reality of what's there. And if that reality is that one side or one individual is more to blame than the other, you have an obligation to report not just both sides, but the truth.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370 from noon to 2, also on WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.